Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about the martial arts with a focus on Kenpo. As always, I am Reggie Darden, and I am very excited to have Mr. Wes Idle with me today. And we're going to talk some Kenpo and probably get onto some other things. We'll see. I'm going to do my best to wrangle things in as we've talked a number of times offline here. We kind of could talk about things for forever and a day. So we will see how it goes. But I'm really excited to have Mr. Idle on. And let's jump into to your story, your journey. How did Kenpo find you? How did you get started? When did you get started? And we'll just take it from there, and whatever rat holes we go on, you know, sorry listeners, but we got plenty of tape, and we're just going to get into it. So yeah. How did Kenpo find you, and where did it all start?
For starters, thank you so much for having me on. And I echo your sentiment. You and I could get lost in our talks, and I would say that's a good sign. So I'm born and raised Los Angeles. And I was one of those, pardon me. I would say, I developed my parents. I was a real handful. I mean, nobody plans on being a handful. It just kind of happened the way it happened. And I just, in Los Angeles, there's a lot of, different extracurricular activities that if you veer off a clean path, you can find yourself on those dirty ones. And I certainly was. And then I found myself in a lot of different neighborhoods, East Los Angeles, South Central LA, and parts of Hollywood, and in Venice as well, Venice Beach. Been shot at a couple times, seen things happen to people that I don't think anybody really should see, and things almost happened to me that I'm grateful they missed. So anyway, I was that. Never did time, but I did a lot of sleepovers, so to speak. So now I'm about 19. And I have just avoided being in one place for the better part of my 20s. And I'm living at my father's house. And for some strange reason, it's a Saturday night. I'm home, which is very odd. And he calls me up and he introduces me to his drinking buddy, Albert Cornejo. And he asked me, my dad, do you want to do karate? And I remember seeing Enter the Dragon as a kid, and that always kind of stuck out in my mind. And I was always a pretty physical kid. I'd been in sports, and I'd certainly been in fights ever since I was a little boy. And that's not a good thing, but I was a physical young man. And I got excited by the idea. He said, great. So I'm down there, and I remember it was Monday, September 1, 1986, and I went down and I met Albert. Albert Cornejo had gotten on the phone that night. He was very nice, like, "Oh, Wes, your dad spoke so well of you. Da da da. And I'd love for you to come down and just see how it feels." And I went down there, and I'm about 6'3", 240, depending on time of year. Anyway, Albert Cornejo is maybe 5'6", not that tall, very in shape. And at that time, he was about 45 years old. And I saw him do something on three men. It was like a three-man attack kind of a thing. And I had never seen anybody move like that before. And what got my attention about it was, I mean, I had also gotten in fights with some Koreans that were in Korean organized crime. in LA. And, you know, I've seen guys fly over pool tables and do flying kicks. And I'd seen people kicking, but I'd never seen anybody look like this. I mean, Albert Cornejo looked like the Tasmanian devil to me in that cartoon. Mm-hmm. And what caught my attention about it is this guy is 40 in his 40s. So that means there's a whole legion of people out there that know this stuff. I need to learn this. So really my draw to it was nothing spiritual. I was moved by the power of it, really. And so I immediately came home and told my dad, I need this uniform and this and this and this. And he thought I was going to go learn a couple tricks and that would be it. But he didn't realize that you don't choose your likes. You just know them when they find you. And that's what happened. Kempo rang a bell inside of me. And so I started training with Albert Cornejo. It was 3 days a week, 2 hour classes. He was very into conditioning. And he was a student of Ed Parker that, although he didn't necessarily teach Ed Parker's system in total, he had carte blanche. Mr. Parker had a long-standing relationship with him, as Mr. Parker had a lot of students. But it was very special, to the point that when I was going across the street to the West LA school, concurrently, I started going across the street to the West LA school at the same, you know, in the same time. So I'd basically do double classes a few times a week, where I'd be at West LA for an hour and a half and then go across street for 2 hours with Cornejo, or the other way around, depending on mm-hmm. what the schedule was, which is kind of insane. I don't know how I did it, but
that was very insane.
Right. I was, you know, 19 and 20 and, anyway, it was, my point is I was wearing a black uniform at West LA as a purple belt. And that was you don't get to wear a black uniform until you're a brown belt and you start going to the advanced classes. And but I had Cornejo kickers embroidered on my leg, which we all had when you're in his class, in his group. And nobody batted an eyelash. It was just because Cornejo was one of those people that Mr. Parker said he can do whatever he wants. And so I was with him for the first 6 years of my training. And well, Cornejo was pretty amazing. The first 2.5 years I was with him, I had a terrific substance abuse problem, drugs and alcohol. And it really kind of had me. And I remember after being with Cornejo a few months, I had shot some of the dry goods in my arm before class. And he picked up on that I was on something. And I remember that night he beat me pretty hard. I mean, you could tell, you know, when you've been in enough fights, you could tell the difference between we're training hard and now you're really putting it on me. And after the class, you know, you all go into there's a locker room where you change. And he walked in the locker room and everybody in the locker room left. Like they all knew there was some conversation happening that I didn't know. And then he sat on the bench and put his face, I think about 6 inches from mine, and very directly said, "If I ever catch you on that crap on my mat again, I'm going to beat you 10 times as hard. And that'll be the last time you're ever allowed to be here. Do you understand?" And I said, "Yes." So for the next 2.5 years, I did all of that substance intake after class, either very early in the morning or after class. When I showed up for class, I was, you know, didn't look like I was on anything, which was a very hard 2.5 years. When I look back, I don't even know how I did that. But, you know, that substance abuse can really take its own toll. And then 2.5 years later, I got thrown into a rehab, and it was in a detox ward, Van Nuys Community Hospital. And I remember at that point, I'd burned a lot of bridges in my life. I mean, family was pretty done with me. A lot of people. And there were other people that were looking for me, you know, clearly to do me harm. And so, but this phone call comes in And the one of the detox techs comes in and said, "Hey, Wes, you got a call." And it's like a payphone, the 1988 in the hallway. And I go over and I pick up the phone. It's not a friend. It's not my family. It's Albert Cunego. And he said, "You're in a good place. Get better and come home." And sorry, it still kind of grabs me a little emotionally, because that's the moment I knew that he's a family member. That was the moment I knew or believed that Kempo can be a family. And subsequently, I did just that. It wasn't a perfect record. I mean, I certainly bounced around a little bit. But I would also say that Kempo, having that focus and having that relationship, really helped steady the keel of my personal ship, as it were. It's always good to have some grounding agents in your life, and Kempo was one of them. And so subsequently, I got a job and was no longer between addresses. That's a nice way of saying homeless. And so everything was working out, and I started to train. I was already training a lot, but then it got just ferocious. Then I remember the end of 1989, I was basically going to West LA, Cornejo, and I started going to Pasadena a little bit, at Parker School in Pasadena. And I had known Frank Trejo, but he was staring at me one night. I think I was about a blue belt. And he basically pulled me into the office later and said, "Hey, do you want to fight professionally?" I got really excited. Said yes. And so all of a sudden I'm going to Pasadena in the mornings and training under Frank Trejo privately. And at the same time, right around that time, Brian Cooper, really close friend of mine, he was, I met him when he first came over from England. He was part of the English invasion with Tony Martin and the like. Graham Lelliott, I believe, now is out here. And Brian actually lived at the West LA studio for a brief time. He just came over, Mr. Parker let him sleep at the studio.
Oh, nice.
Anyway, so Larry Tatum was already left the West LA studio. He got let go as the manager. And as I said, it was the end of 1989. And at that same time, when I started with Trejo, Brian Cooper said, "Hey, why don't you come with me over to Larry Tatum's house? This is where I'm training." I mean, we trained at Cornejo's three times a week, a lot of heavy conditioning and bag work. But I got excited by the idea of going to Larry. And just like with Frank Trejo, I went back to Albert Cornejo. I said, "Hey, Mr. Cornejo, are you okay if I, how do you feel about me training with Trejo in the mornings?" He says, "Oh, it's great. Mr. Trejo is awesome." I came to him and I said, "Mr. Cornejo, Sifu, I used to call him. I said, how do you feel about if I went over to Larry Tatum's house once a week to train?" He said, "Wes, Larry is a technician, and as long as it doesn't conflict with our classes, absolutely." He was really good about that. Cornejo was always upfront with me, but he was always very open to let me see and experience anything outside the school. He was confident, mm-hmm. right? There was no insecurity with him. And so subsequently, now I'm at Larry Tatum's house, and this is before Larry Tatum opened his school on Green Street. And that was a pretty amazing time when I look back. Training under Cornejo, training at Larry's house, training with Frank Trejo, thinking I'm going to be a professional fighter. I don't think we realize, it's sort of like Pigpen, that Charlie Brown character. Mm-hmm. I don't think he even realizes what he's in the middle of.
You know?
And I didn't realize how good I had it being here in Los Angeles and training with who I was training with. Subsequently, I remember going to, Mr. Parker had, I remember meeting Mr. Parker, actually. It was in when I started going to West LA. So this had to be, and Brian Hawkins had been hired as the West LA manager. So Larry Tatum was let go and Brian Hawkins got hired. So this has to be 1987. That sounds about right. Because I think I was with Cornejo about 6 months or 5 months, and then I started to go to West LA across the street. Mm-hmm. And Hawkins, you know, I got together with him and he gave me the rules and said, now you can go ahead and wear your black uniform. We all know Mr. Cornejo has a special relationship with Mr. Parker. Mr. Parker's very clear. It's okay. And I said, I don't mind getting a white uniform. He says, and Hawkins is great. He said, it's not necessary. It's totally up to you. We really appreciate and respect Mr. Cornejo. But he did say, when it comes to advanced class, you can come and watch it once, but then you cannot return until you're brown belt. So, of course, the very next Thursday, I can't wait. I want to see it.
Oh, yeah.
And looking back, that's when I met Mr. Parker. And I remember he came out. This is 87, and he was pretty heavy set already. And honestly, I had never met him before or seen him move before. So I thought, oh my, he's kind of overweight. I wonder if he can even move. I'm thinking all of this, not mm-hmm. saying anything. And then he did what I now know is flashing mace. And I was shocked. It looked like a building on exploding wheels. I had never seen anybody that big move that fast. And I remember I could see his hair trying to catch up to his body. He had that little hair shake that you mm-hmm. see him do.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what it was. He wasn't shaking his head. It just, his hair was catching up to the turns and the stomps. And it was shocking when I saw him move. It was a wake-up call. And there were a lot of brown and black belts in that class. Looking back, I remember Hawkins being there. Jeff Speakman was in that class. I believe Barbara Hale was there. It was that Thursday night advanced class. Mm-hmm. There were probably other people that at the time I didn't know. But anyway, after class, I'm the only one sitting in the bleachers. Mm-hmm. They were like step bleachers by the front door where you could watch class. And Mr. Parker came over. And I immediately jumped up and I said, oh, Mr. Parker, my name is Wes Heidel. I'm a student of Albert Cornejo. And then he reached his arms straight out to reach for my handshake. And I remember telling Howard Silva the story that, oh, yeah, he reached his arms all the way straight. And Howard Silva says, wait a second, Mr. Parker reached his arms straight, like right off his body? I was like, yeah, yeah. And he said, what did you tell him? And I said, oh, I just said I'm a student of Albert Cornejo. And Howard Silva said, God damn it, Mr. Parker loved Albert Cornejo. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing. I didn't know Mr. Parker, of course. So I didn't know that usually when he would shake people's hands, he might more often keep his elbows next to his body. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it's a conscious thing, but he wouldn't generally reach out like this. I mean, he really, and I do remember when I said Cornejo's name, he really lit up. I do remember that. And I had a chance to kind of see Mr. Parker a couple times. I did not have any kind of relationship with him. Although I do remember one time at Internationals, I did see him flip his lid. And I saw that other side of Mr. Parker. And there was a particular black belt, they'll go nameless. They were sitting right next to me and Albert Cornejo while we were watching the black belts fight. It used to be on Sunday night internationals. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Parker came storming over to where we were and he ripped this black belt, a new one. And I'm just sitting there shutting my mouth, watching a flurry of high volume and obscenities fly out of Mr. Parker's mouth. And this black belt who was talking all this trash moments before just shrunk in his seat. And of course, then he stands up to attention and does what Mr. Parker tells him to do. And after everything kind of left, Mr. Parker kind of suddenly brought himself back down to regular temperature and realized Mr. Cornejo was right there. And he goes, oh, Alberto, how are you? He goes, oh, Mr. Parker, I'm good. He's like, good to see you. And then he sort of rushed off. And I remember Mr. Cornejo, he just kept looking forward and he, he says that black belt's name. I'm not going to say their name. And he said, yeah, blah, blah. He's got a big mouth. Then we kept watching the black belts. I remember Mr. Parker passing away. And I remember going to the funeral. I think it seemed like there could have been 2,000 people. It was very, very big. It was, if I recall, I feel like it was at a particular church in Pasadena or somewhere in that area. I can't recall the exact location. But I remember you'd walk in and there was this other side viewing room. And I remember at the time I didn't know him, but there was Mike Pick at that door and he decided who was allowed to come into that viewing area. And I just remember going all the way into the main room and seeing everybody and of course watching the service. Some people I did recognize, some people I didn't. But I do remember it was about the next month I finally got my brown belt from Albuquerque, Cornejo. And I was a little angry. I was angry that Mr. Parker passed away before I had an opportunity to train with him. Yeah. I never said it out loud, but I felt a little robbed.
No, I'm right there with you. So I didn't get started until after seeing The Perfect Weapon. And it was couldn't I have found it? Couldn't you put this movie out a couple of years earlier? And I would have had a chance to meet the man. And things work out the way they do. Right,
yeah, West LA was very close to where I used to live when I was a 10-year-old with my dad. I thought, oh my God, that would have been the time to start. Anyway, but I remember the brown belt. Okay, so I'm going to start going to advanced class. And I went back to West LA, and unfortunately, Brian Hawkins wasn't there anymore. And this is, I'd have to look at the dates, but I feel like this has got to be, it's got to be 91, probably January 91. Yeah, it was about a month after Mr. Parker passed. So anyway, I don't know, but I think I went in the phone book or something, and I found out, or I asked somebody, and I found out where Hawkins went. Hawkins just, I guess there was some decision that was made that he was finally going to leave West LA and do his own thing. And I'd known Mr. Hawkins and I had seen him move before, but the time I really hadn't seen him in a couple of years. And I was spending a lot of time, with Cornejo and Trejo and Tatum, and sometimes Mohammed Toba Tabai going to his school. But my West LA days weren't as much I went some, but not as much as the others. And then, I went to that one advanced class and I saw Mr. Hawkins move and I was in awe because it reminded me of that first night I saw Mr. Parker move. Now at this point, my eyes are far more educated. Like when I saw Mr. Parker move, there's a bunch of stuff I probably didn't quite see because I had young eyes, you know what I mean? But my eyes were far more educated and I was astonished. I'm sure he was always a great mover, but he spent a lot of time Mr. Parker. Starting in 1987, he was in Mr. Parker's house twice a week. And then there was the one day a week that Mr. Parker would come to West LA. And what Mr. Parker had done with Hawkins is he was already preparing to revamp the whole system. Understanding now is probably somewhere around 1985, Mr. Parker was at some school and there was some test. He was testing board he was on, and somebody was doing a very familiar technique like five swords or something of that nature. And Mr. Parker didn't recognize the technique. He knew what the technique was. But it's like the teacher of that school had gotten so far away from what Mr. Parker was teaching that it was almost unrecognizable. And allegedly, that was the time that Mr. Parker said, that's it. Every school needs to be updated. So he started to go into the system on his own, and he was cleaning up everything. And you could call this really the fifth version of this, of our system. First one was what he learned from Chow, which was no forms and no techniques, a lot of drills and breaking. The next version is when he started training under Lao Boon in San Francisco, and that's where he met Jimmy Wing Wu. And of course, Bookset and Tiger and Crane were in our system. The third version of Kempo would be the 32 system. And then the fourth version of our system is when he added the guns and knives and went to the 24 system. And then, of course, there's the fifth version of our system, which is when he went through everything and revamped it. And he revamped, like, everything got touched, even black belt, two-man set, and all the forms and all the sets and all the techniques. Some of them may not have been hugely adjusted, but some were. And so in 1987, when he had Hawkins come to his house, he had already, Bishop Parker had already talked to a few people. And there were several people that said, hey, Mr. Parker, if you're trying to replace, you know, you need a new manager of West LA, Brian Hawkins would be a good one. And at the time, Mohammed Tabatabai was really the senior rank there. And, but I feel like for some reason, Mohammed didn't take the offer, or possibly Mr. Parker talked to him about it and he didn't take it. And Mr. Mohammed was absolutely one of the better movers in that school. He was certainly one that I looked up to for sure. And he was a fourth at the time, if I remember. And he moved, you know, when you see a Kempoist that they're no longer human, how he moved to me. It was amazing. And, but it was to be Hawkins. And then Hawkins went over to Mr. Parker's house after several people said Hawkins is the one, he'd be perfect. And he told Hawkins, what we're going to do is we are going to update every school in the world. And, but we're going to, first we're going to go to West LA, and then we're going to go to Pasadena, and then we're going to go to every other school, but we're going to start with West LA, which means we're going to start with you. And he said, you're going to come to my house one day a week. We're going to do this physical material. And then you're going to come another day a week. And it's just going to be you and I. And that's when you're going to, because it's starting with you, you need to know who's who in the zoo. And that was the day where he told Hawkins to ask him about anybody and everybody. And I still say that if Hawkins ever wanted to, though he never would, it's not in his character, he could write a book that would be terribly exposing some people in Kempo. But Mr. Parker wanted him to have a reference of who's who. And I remember to a benefit, I'll use a positive example. He had met Mike Peck, Hawkins. But I remember when he asked Mr. Parker about Mike Peck, that was the only student that Mr. Parker said, Mike really took the knife somewhere. Mike Peck was really his only real knife student. And he also played a major role in the development of Kempo knife strategies, which also includes Form 9 and Form 10, which later Mr. Parker were going to put into the system. And then of course there's other people that are absolute charlatans, and Mr. Parker let them know they were charlatans he let Hawkins know they were charlatans. I think what I really lucked out about it is when I started going to advanced class with Mr. Hawkins, what I hadn't known is that he was spending so much time with Mr. Parker. And he also, during the 3.5 years he was with Mr. Parker at his house, he was, you know, when they were revising the endings and even some of the techniques, Mr. Hawkins was right there in the middle of it. And so he was getting this real understanding of not only how the movement Mr. Parker wanted, but how Mr. Parker thought, and even how Mr. Parker wrote down his thoughts on how to apply stuff. And I think it was perfect for me because I really wanted, I was so moved by Kempo. I want to get inside the head of someone that did what Mr. Parker did. And at the time there was probably no better instructor than Hawkins. He was very generous with me. I don't even know that he knows why he was so generous with me. But I was in this great position that he started to like throw a bunch of material on me. Even before I became a full-time student of his, I was just going to advanced class for about a year. And then I remembered Mr. Cornejo had, he promoted me to second brown. And then I remember I really wanted to be a whole student of Mr. Hawkins. I loved Frank Trejo. He was amazing to me. Larry Tatum was very generous with me. I really appreciate that. But Cornejo was always my instructor. But this was the time I was really about to make a big move. And I went to Mr. Cornejo, and I had the idea that I wasn't necessarily going to tell him what I want to do. I wanted to tell him what I was thinking, and I wanted to know how he felt about it. That feels more like a better conversation. That's like a real conversation, you know? And he was great. He spoke very well of Hawkins, and he's very respectful. He's very talented. He's very knowledgeable. Though I could tell Cornejo didn't love the idea, because he loved me. And we were family. I was like his son, one of his sons, kind of. But it's funny, he actually went to Jimmy Wing Wu to get a black belt. And Mr. Parker hated Jimmy Wing Wu after they had their breakup. But he was very upfront with Mr. Parker. He said, Mr. Parker, I want to go get a black belt from Jimmy Wing Wu. I want to know how you feel about it. And although Mr. Parker hated it, he said to him, Albert, you do what you got to do. And so then Cornejo ironically said to me, Wes, I'm going to tell you what Mr. Parker told me when I went to go get a black belt from Jimmy Wing Wu. Wes, you do what you got to do. And he didn't come to my first degree brown, my first degree black, my second degree black. But when I was testing for third degree black, then Cornejo started to come to those tests. He was always invited. Hawkins always invited him. But Cornejo, he just didn't want there to be any confusion. And he said to me privately years later, he said, Wes, I didn't come to those earlier tests because you were a Hawkins black belt. And I wanted it to be clear, because if I started coming to every one of those early tests, it'd be a little confusing. But by the time you went for third, I think everybody knew you're a Hawkins black belt. And now I can start coming and, you know, openly being there in those celebrations. Anyway, so with my time with Hawkins it was incredible. It was Hawkins, like Frank Trejo, like Chuck Sullivan, Hawkins is very honest. And his memory, the fish never gets bigger over time. Not everybody is like that. So I really benefited from that. He has extraordinary memory. He's very intelligent, but it's always the same story. And it's always the truth, which is good. So
yeah, definitely gonna have to have that.
Right. And in that time, I think I even remember when I got my second black, Hawkins said, Wes, I want you to start coming to the school on Thursdays. I think it was like 4 o'clock, maybe 3 o'clock. I think it was 4 o'clock. And he said, we're going to start going through the whole system privately from beginning to end. And he later said, because remember we talked about it, he later said, Wes, I needed somebody else that really knew all the details that I went over, that Mr. Parker went over with me. I was also teaching there a lot, of course. And so he privately took me step by step, starting at Star Block all the way through the first belt of endings in Form 7. And his attention to detail is like few I've ever known. But during that time, I remember I got exposed to some other people that I had not before, Bob Lyles. But one of the big ones was Mike Peck. I went to in 1990. Was it 90? Yes, it was 90. May 90, I went to Albert Cuneo took me and Brian Cooper and some other guys to a seminar he was putting on. Barbara Hale was putting on her school, and she had Mike Peck teaching. And I had never seen anybody move so much like Mr. Parker than Mike Peck. And again, he was like a building on exploding wheels, you know? And some of the things he talked about, I'd never heard anybody talk about. Like, he talked about grabbing a quarter inch round stake and wiring it between two trees and sticking your fingers through it and clawing it. And because you can't really do that to each other without injuring each other. But he wanted you, this way you can really put your hands on flesh and get an idea of what that really feels like. And I'll never, and he hit me in a way. He did thundering hammers on me, and I have never, ever felt such an electric hammering. But this is 9 years later. In 1999, I saw that he had taken a promotion to 10th. And I sent him an email questioning it. I'm sure I put as respectful language as I can together, but I was questioning it is what I was doing. I don't know where I thought I had any right to do that, but he responded in an email so generously and kindly, and then invited me to come to one of his classes. He was putting on a class at a school in San Jose. And I showed Mr. Hawkins. I remember Mr. Hawkins said, I showed him the email. I was a little forward. And Hawkins said to me, you sent this to Mike Pick? I said, yes, I did, sir. He's like, oh my God, what did he say? And so I showed him the email, responded. And he goes, well, Wes, it was pretty bold of you to question him, but here's the thing. I know Mike Pick very well. And there are some possibilities that could come out of this visit. I want you to really keep your wares about you. There are very few people that can hit like Mike Peck, but there is a very good possibility you're going to experience one of the best teaching experiences you'll ever experience. I just don't know which way this is going to go. And sure enough, it was that. I met Mr. Pick. I was in this class, and he was really generous with me. And of course, I asked Hawkins about training with him and going to these things. And Hawkins always said, he said, Wes, there is nobody like Mike Pick in Mr. Parker's art. And there's things that Mike Pick did with Mr. Parker that Mr. Parker didn't do with anybody else. And not only a personal relationship, but this is one of the one guys that literally breathes tempo. He came to Mr. Parker when he was a 10-year-old, when there were no kids. I mean, you could argue he might have been the first non-Asian child martial artist in America, maybe 1957, I don't know. And he created a really significant relationship with him. And so since 1999, I was able to train with Mike Peck. Also, Hawkins being my primary instructor, and I still get to train under Mike Peck. And he's never asked me to wear his crest. He's never asked me to join his association. But in 2008, when Roy McDonald had that huge gathering in the Isle of Jersey, just off the coast of between England and France. I think it's in the English Channel. It's kind of considered part of England. He invited, I don't know, 135 different countries. It was a really huge event in 2008. And they invited Mike Peck. And he was basically, that was going to be the first time somebody introduced Kenpo knife strategies to Europe. So Mike Pick asked me, he says, at this point, I had been with Mr. Pick as a student for 9 years. I'd basically travel and I would see Mr. Pick 3 times a year for like 2 or 3 days. That was kind of my training with him. Because he put on these gatherings gatherings, and I'd either go to his house or we'd meet at somebody else's, or he would come train us in LA. But we did that like 3 times a year. Anyway, he asked me, he says, Wes, what do you think about this invite? And I said, Mr. Pick, this is a very, I think this is a big deal. I think you should go, but I also think you should take at least one, if not two people with you, because the way you move and this Kempo knife applications are so detailed, and I don't think people are going to be used to it. So they're going to need more than just you there as a teacher. So I would take, a couple of people that, know your stuff that can help teach. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, well, who else should we grab? I said, what do you mean? Who else? He goes, well, you're coming. I think, no, Mr. Pitt, I wasn't saying I should go. He says, no, that you should go. And then of course the other one was Marcus Bonfiglio, who is he was a longtime student of Mike Peck. Very, very good. And so we went to Europe, and that opened up a whole nother adventure, because I remember standing on the floor one of the days. I'm standing with Reiner Schulte, who I'd befriended, and two very Irish, very pissed off men came up to us. I'd come to find out it was Morris Mahan and Tommy Jordan, two of the most senior Kempoists in Europe. And although they're up there in age, they are not lacking in physicality. Dare I make up a word? And they were so pissed off, and they were starting to rage a little, yelling at Reiner Schulte. And you get a sense. If you've been in enough fights, you know somebody walking up to you can probably throw a punch or can't. And everything in my gut told me that both these men can move. And I had this suspicion that Morris Mahan is getting very close to throwing a punch. Mm. And I thought, what the hell am I going to do? And now what am I going to do? I'm going to get into it right here on the floor with these men. And I'm in a foreign country. God knows what that looks like. I mean, all this stuff swirling around in my head. So, and they're really hammering Reiner Schulte. And I step in and I kindly say, gentlemen, to some extent, look, there's clearly been some fallout in communication. Clearly something's happened. But whatever has happened, I'm sure that the wrong can be acknowledged and it can be righted with an amends. And they kind of cooled down. You know, they felt heard. And so subsequently that night, we sat down with a meeting of, it was all around, Reiner Schulte was claiming that he was the first to bring American Kempo to Europe, but he really wasn't. It's okay. It's not a huge thing, but it was very insulting to these people. Mm-hmm. I mean, he might have been teaching a revised version, mm-hmm. but that would be like me. Like, sure, I've learned Mr. Parker's final version of Kempo, but does that mean I know more than people that don't know the final version? You know, you can't do that. It's not. So that was their claim. And they really were the first, and they have a rightful heir to it. So we sat down, Mike Pick, Marcus Bonfiglio, myself, and a collection of men from Ireland. I have a list of the names, but it was about 9 men. And Morris Mahan was there. Tommy Jordan was there, of course. And we listened to their grievances. Reiner Schulte couldn't come. He actually had other plans. And it was all happened very quickly. Like that night, we put this roundtable discussion together. And what it turned out to be was the next year and a half, I was right in the middle with the help of Tommy Jordan, Mike Pick, and a legion of people across the world, putting together documents, putting together true dates, news clippings to really establish the true history of Kempo in Europe. And I could not have done it with all these people. I could not have done it without Tommy Jordan, without Mike Pick, without Chuck Sullivan, Dave Hebler. There are so many people that without them, it couldn't be done. But what was great about it was I was given the honor of authoring this document that really proved when things started and who started it. And it was my responsibility to, I think we had 1, 2, 3, 4 original copies of this document. I have one of them. Mike Vick has another. And I think Tommy Jordan and Morris Mahan have, they have one each. And there's copies of it, but we, these were the originals, the wet signatures, as it were. And before we went back to Ireland to present this at a huge gathering, it was my responsibility to get our signatures from America. And so I was the one that went to Chuck Sullivan. I'd had a long-time relationship with him. To Dave Hebler, I had a long-time relationship with him, and they all trusted me, and I was honored to be a part of it. And then we flew back to Europe, and we did this huge presentation, and it was a video signing of when Mike Pick and Morris Mahan and Tommy Jordan, Willie Kelly, all these other people involved were there as well. Marcus Bonfiglio was in there, Sean Kelly, because he was had a relationship with Mr. Pick, so he was involved as well. And it was great. I mean, it's like being catapulted into another life, you know?
Oh yeah, for sure.
God, I've said so much and you've only asked one question.
No, that, you know, I love it. And, you know, as we've kind of discussed before, I mean, we're going to have to do like 50 million parts because there's so many avenues that we can get into. But, you know, like I jokingly say, but I think I'm probably pretty serious about it, is one thing that's great about this, doing this show, is that Kenpo people love to talk. And so it makes my job easier because I don't have to say much. I just let them go. I love the stories. I love that, you know, I'm kind of jealous that you've been, you know, you kind of mentioned it before in that you're just very, you know, blessed, fortunate to be around these, you know, names in this time, and you know, kind of things just kind of fell into that right timing. And I can relate being around, kind of being around these big people and kind of not really realizing it at the time, but then you look back and it's like, holy crap, I was you know, training with this person, I was hanging with this person, or these people were directly influential to my training, and you know, I just didn't really even think about
it was also so important to me, and I don't mean important, but it meant a lot to me, it still does, that because of the relationships I have with these people, that I was able to know the truth about a lot of stuff that really happened. And I think it's so important to make sure the truth is what's kept up for next generations to come. Because I, unfortunately, there's people that have, maybe for reasons of insecurity, and maybe they want to be viewed as something more than they really are, they start twisting history, and that's a bad idea. I think history that really happened is what should be set there. Like, I remember there was some story that Jim Mitchell, he had a real bad falling out with Mr. Parker, and he got kicked out of the IKKA, and he earned that. Yes, of course, he definitely played a part in writing down a lot of material, the endings and stuff, and helped out with some videos, but later on, he just had this lack of honesty. And I remember he used to tell this one story that Mr. Parker used to buy a collection of stained glass windows extra, because so often someone would try to take him on at the school and he'd throw them through the window. And I remember the first time I heard him tell that story, of course I wasn't there, but you know, you get a gut feeling. Like, you don't have the details, but you know this person's full of it. Mm-hmm. And I remember, and he's telling this story in front of a bunch of people, and I thought, this is, and I remember talking to Mike Pick one day. Yes, people would come into the studio and try to take on Mr. Parker. That happened. And there was one day that Pick and Mr. Parker were in the Pasadena school in the office, and a guy came in. And I don't know the exact setups, but I think he came in and I believe it was something not okay. And I think he had a firearm on him. Mr. Parker really liked firearms. And he had a little 2-shot Derringer in his desk drawer at Pasadena. And as this person came in, before Pitt could intercept the guy, Mr. Parker got out from around the desk, grabbed this little Derringer, somehow dealt with the guy's hand. I don't know if the guy had he might have had a handgun, but I can't remember. It might have been he had some weapon. Anyway, Mr. Parker quickly got around and put this Derringer right up to the side of his cheek. And I think the guy had a firearm. Anyway, but instead of firing it, he somehow used the sight piece of the Derringer and cut it across his cheek, and then they smacked him around and threw him out. And Mr. Pick later said, "Mr. Parker, you had it right up to your cheek. Why didn't you fire it?" And Mr. Parker said, "Mike, if I fired it, it would have gone through his cheek and it would have broke that stained glass window. Do you know how expensive those things are?" And I was like, okay, that's more, you know. So, because I mean, the idea is somebody's going to buy a bunch of windows because they're going to throw something through it, people through it, is just kind of ridiculous. So,
yeah.
And I think it's really important. And there's some people that say, "Oh, Mr. Parker taught two different systems, one for the commercial business of it and one the real business, the real Kempo," which again is another total fallacy. And it's usually people that they want to be seen more than who they really are. But I think that's also an important piece of history, because could you imagine if you've been training in Kempo and then you find out this isn't really the real thing, you'd feel a little less than or a little cheated, you know? Well, the good news is that's not true. It's just a story somebody has put up so that they can seem like they have the real secrets, and they don't. Ironically, the first time I heard that particular story, it came from somebody that actually was never a real student of Mr. Parker, a private student. We'll go ahead and let them remain nameless right now. to me, that's where the importance of truth is. Just because when next generations are coming up, they don't have the real life people to know who's who in the zoo. So it's like our job to make sure we pass on the true history of it. And so that's why, to me, it's so important, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, that's one of the things that I would like to accomplish with this show is to get all of this various information out there, you know, good, bad, ugly. Let's at least get it out there. And then we can, each person can kind of triangulate the information, on their own. I kind of liken it to, Amazon reviews. You see a product and it's got a bunch of reviews, and you don't just look at just the best reviews and the worst reviews. You can look at the stuff in the middle, and then you can kind of get a better idea of what's really what's really the real thing. And I don't get into it with any guest, or I think I've been doing pretty good with not getting into the politics and the drama with any of the guests. And,
right.
I don't necessarily shy away from it, but I don't just immediately, if somebody says something that, you know, maybe I don't agree with, or the community in general doesn't agree with, you know, I don't try to shy away from letting them say it. I just let them say it, and, you know, we'll let each listener decide whether they want to follow that or not. And, you know, try not to ask anything so that, you know, maybe people don't think that I think a certain way. You know, it's like, you know, you know, views, you know, represented on the show do not reflect the views of this station, you know, sort of thing. But I just want to get everything out there, and then, you know, I can decide for myself what I want to follow, and the listeners can decide what they want to follow. And, you know, there's going to be good information. There's going to be bad information. There's going to be questionable mm-hmm. information. I think at the end of the day, a lot of it is just kind of splitting hairs.
I
think a lot of it is, you know, with Ed Parker continuously evolving the system. Yeah, we're all going to get, you know, different sides of it. And,
Not
just Kenpo. You look at, so at the time of our recording here, I'm kind of in a transitional period in my training and journey, and being involved in other arts and experimenting with other arts. I've the same sorts of drama and politics and whatnot that we have in Kenpo exist in Hapkido, in Kyokushin, Capoeira, in FMA. It's crazy in Shotokan. It's like, oh my God, like is this just part of martial arts? But I think it's just part of, you know, being human. I think
it's kind of seductive for some people when someone gives you attention, let's say you're speaking in front of a big room. There was a book called Celestine Prophecy written years ago. And one of the ideas in that book was, when I'm listening to you, I am giving you my energy. And then when you're listening to me, you're giving me yours. And so a conversation is a back and forth pumping of each other. But if you take that idea further, let's say you're one person speaking to a big group of people. That whole group is throwing their energy into you. And then you hear about comedians and musicians and actors, that there's nothing like a live audience. And I think about that idea, and I wonder if that's why they talk about the live feedback. But maybe, what if vibrationally it's more than that? Maybe the whole room is filling this person with this almost powerful, really. And so attention can be almost acquiring vibrationally, you know, some energy, for lack of a better term. And I think if that's true, some people are seduced by it, that they want to continue to get as much of that as they can. It's almost like addiction. You know, there's never too much. And you'll do whatever you can to keep getting it. So then we start getting into twisting the truth, because they really want to be seen. They want more of that energy. And that's kind of how I've started to view it. You know, the slip away is, oh, they're insecure, they really want to be. But you wonder, like, why do you really want to be? And I think that might be it. I think it's just a little seductive. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to stay right-sized. And so, you know, recently this year I got promoted to 8th degree by Brian Hawkins. And Mike Pick is on the certificate and very supportive of the promotion. And it wasn't anything I saw coming. I've been in Kenpo since 1986 and continuously really training. And honestly, I was a little uncomfortable with it because of the title that degree comes with, which is associate master. It almost turned my stomach. I always thought about rank as responsibility. It's not it's not a validation of me. It's just a new responsibility upon me, is how I see it. And I really, you know, when you get to these lower ranks of black, you're expected to know a certain amount of material for first black. And then there's a certain amount of material for second and third and fourth and even fifth. But when you get into some of those ranks above, there isn't necessarily a specific type of material you're to know. The reference is how much you're contributing to the art. But there's not a value to it. So what is it? And so then, but like I said, when I was bestowed this rank, I didn't like it. I don't like the word master. It feels it feels pretentious, and I had a lot of trouble getting my arms around it. And I was speaking to a dear friend who's a very high-ranking black belt, and I shared with them my discomfort of it. And then they very kindly said, "Wes, that's one of the reasons why you've earned it." And I take it back to that idea of staying right-sized. And I think if everybody could do that, and it doesn't mean you can't be confident about your own abilities. I'll say without hesitation, there's aspects of Kenpo I believe I know that 99% of the world don't. And it's not that I'm better than them. That's just what's for dinner. It's not who I am. It's just who I've had the gift of being trained by. That's all. But I really think it's important that we always look at rank as responsibility. I think there are many people that have put on rank that I don't think they should have put on. But I will take the position of always respecting that rank, even if I think it's being hung around the waist of someone that shouldn't have it. I've got two choices. I can either disrespect it or respect it. And I would rather take the position of, you know, if they're teaching class, put my knot to the left, because that's what students do. And there are plenty of people out there that are in that class that really shouldn't be wearing what they're wearing. But it's just more important that I behave in a way that is what hopefully we're all striving towards. And then, by the way, there's some people out there that are extraordinary, extraordinary. So it's not all bad, but I do think that absolute power doesn't corrupt absolutely. I just think it's important that we really stay rooted in who we really are deep down within. You've heard people say that money can corrupt or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I think more money just magnifies who you are. If you're a great person, more money is just going to make you more of a great person. But if you're kind of a jerk, more money is going to magnify that you really are a jerk.
No, for sure.
So the real job is just let's really stay right-sized. And there's so many ways you can say it. Remain teachable is one way of saying it. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Mr. Parker was human too. And I say that because I love some of the stories of how some material got created. I remember Chuck Sullivan telling me the story of Staff Set. You know, there's a lot of material that came out of Lao Boon, which a lot of people don't know. Mr. Parker was a student of his, and a lot of material came out and inspired Mr. Parker. And Staff Set is one of them. And it might have, I don't know if that was directly from Lao Boon or if it came through Jimmy Wing Wu, because Jimmy Wing Wu was a student of Lao Boon as well, and he had moved down here. Because Loud Bones in San Francisco. Anyway, so Mr. Parker learned the staff set, and then he taught it to Chuck Sullivan. And Chuck Sullivan told me, oh, Wes, it was really long. And there were some parts of it I didn't really like. But then a couple days later, or maybe a week later, but very soon, Mr. Parker said, hey, show me that staff set I showed you. And Wes, I did it. And honestly, some of the stuff I didn't like, I left out. And some of the stuff I just didn't remember. It was so long. Mr. Parker picked up on it. He goes, hey, that isn't exactly what I showed you. And I said to him, oh, I couldn't remember all of it. And some of it I didn't really like. And then Mr. Parker said, that's fine. That'll be our staff set. And that's how it got done. It wasn't, you know, the mystics came to Mr. Parker in a dream. No, we're just working with what we got. That a lot of stuff is a work in progress. You know, that's why it makes so much sense that, and some of the techniques in our system, he made up on the spot. Darting leaves, I think that's the, God, what is that? Is that the second technique in Form 4, I think? He did that. That was something he did on a guy that tried to throw a punch at him. Or, God, what's another one? Twist of Fate. That was something he did on a guy. He was in the Coast Guard. And he did this thing where it was almost, you know, it was a push and grabbed his hands and stepped through and flipped the guy over on his back. And he later thought, wow, that's a pretty good technique. I'm going to write that down. It was something that just happened in the moment. And of course, later it got shaped a little more and shaped a little more, you know. But a lot of these original impetus for the creation of things in his system might have just been in spur of the moment, which is credit to the moment, but also really credit to Ed Parker. When I look at the history, you look at how Chow moved physically. Mr. Parker definitely looked like that. There's that whipping hammer fist and just the way he moved. And you could tell that he spent time with Chow. But if you see the way Lao Boon moves, you can see some of Lao Boon's material in our material, but you could tell that's not really, you know, how Parker moved so much. There was just certain techniques and forms, but that movement came out of it. But the other one is historically like Potosi. Potosi was not a martial artist. He was like really a plagiarist. And it's funny how he met Professor Chow. Matosi was involved in some not entirely legal business stuff. We'll say it that way. And so he, at a very young age, I think he was like 20, 21, he needed protection. So they hired two bodyguards. One was the Japanese judo champion who lived in that part of Hawaii. And another one was a local legend called Willie Chow. And that's how they met. Now, setting aside what Matosi was involved in, the important part of the story is that he played no part in the creation of our martial art. There is a man that he plagiarized a great deal of material from. And he plagiarized a whole book, and it was really unfortunate. But if you really look at what are the roots of us, Mr. Parker really had how Chow moved and thought. He was very much about taking, like, he might take some old ancient techniques, for lack of a better term, and make it more realistic. It's more applicable. So then there's that. And then there's, I think Mr. Parker spent, you know, he certainly did a lot of time. He did judo when he was younger, as a before Kempo. And it's funny, if you look at all of our grab techniques, you know, lone kimono and whatever. Pick any of them, whether we're grabbing from the throat or the wrist or the lapel. All of those originally started out as judo grabs that were going to turn into a lock or a throw. That's what Mr. Parker was doing. He was trying to come up with techniques that would count because he had some experience with judo. And in judo, of course, there's some levels of jiu-jitsu in it. So they're turned into locks. They may not actually be throws. So all of those grab techniques were the beginning of one of their techniques. And he was trying to create a technique to stop that, which I thought was, that's really interesting. And not a lot of people know that. So, and then also, Mr. Parker definitely had experience in boxing. The knife stuff, Mr. Parker was not, he respected Filipino. He was actually the one that even told Danny Nosanto, hey, you should go check out your countrymen. They have a whole system, because Danny Nosanto is Filipino. He's a black belt under Mr. Parker, but he was the one that sent him in that direction. And, but he, like later on, I know that, we'll leave him nameless, but there was an individual that kept trying to have Filipino teachers come to the Pasadena studio and teach. Mr. Parker never wanted that to be the case, because as much as he respected Filipino strategies and their due respect for how fluid and versatile they are not Kempo knife. He and Mr. Parker really liked knives. Knives and guns were a big deal to him, a big, big deal. And I remember speaking to Mike Pick about this. He was really the one that had a lot of experience with this because of his relationship with him. And like he did Form 8, which was really Form 7 originally before he did the stick form. And he created that in the 60s. And then he, Mike Pick came back from Vietnam and they got together, and a lot of the applications that Mr. Pick had learned through the Marine Corps and military applications, and how Mike Pick kind of thought, that was the impetus for knife set. And, but if you really look at that knife application, Kempo knife is really, you are cutting, but you're doing so much striking, blocking, and hooking, kind of like the way we block or the way we hook. You're really striking with a knife. You're really striking to their bones. You're dealing with their skeleton. Like there are a lot of knife systems that'll talk about cutting a tendon or cutting a muscle, when a great deal of Kempo strategy is striking all the way to the bone, and then we'll get to the muscle on the way. I mean, there are some little things that Mr. Parker did like. He called it tenderizing, where he's sort of flicking with the end of the knife. But when you look at the development of it, Kempo knife strategies are much, much more about striking their body with those knives than it is just cutting flesh. I guess my point in bringing that up is, I want us to make sure we keep the truth of that story moving forward, not to discredit other arts, but to really get clear about who we are. A lot of stuff got evolved. Like I said, over the years, Mr. Parker did a lot of refining. I mean, I remember there were some people that came back to West LA in the late 80s when he brought in Hawkins as the manager. And there were some that were very high ranking under Mr. Parker, but they were still training, but they hadn't really been training with Mr. Parker for more than, a good portion of years. And when they started coming back to those advanced classes, they had trouble adapting to some of the changes that Mr. Parker had made. So that system was changing very, very rapidly as well. Now, I know some people want to say, hey, the system needs to be evolving. And I appreciate that, though I find it interesting that many of those people that claim that never really learned the revised version anyway. So I don't know how you can evolve a system that you never even totally learned. They're going to go nameless. But they are there. Their faces are in my head right now. God bless them. I really appreciate their love and commitment to Kempo, but I think first things first, let's not lose what Mr. Parker left us. Just add to it. And you can add in many different ways. To me, I just think there are so many pieces of gold in what Mr. Parker left us. I just don't want us to lose that. That's all. If we can, and I think some people, there's some, they don't believe in the endings. I've even heard people say things like, oh, it's just created to have more materials so you can keep the student. And that's not even close to truth. If you really learn the endings, you'll find out there are pieces of timing in the endings that are not in the base techniques. There are types of takedowns and breaks that are not in the base techniques. So there is a lot to be learned in those endings. I know some people that they don't really like the sets, but there's some good things in it. Kicking set two. There are some crazy kicks in there that are actually very difficult to do. But if you can learn how to do spinning, hooking, heel kick, and actually maintain correct alignment, come all the way around, you are a very coordinated individual.
Oh yeah, no,
I mean, to actually.
I've been working on that very set lately. So, yeah, I can.
Well, there's that one act. You know how you do a step through heel kick, a hooking you heel scoop kick from behind, and then you do a spinning hooking heel. That hooking heel is supposed to be a vertical plane. So your body is spinning on a horizontal, and then right when you get to the apex, you've got to do a quick vertical scoop and then continue your reaction. That's not easy to do.
No, it is not.
Because so many people, they turn the hook into like a horizontal plane hook, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And to me, I just don't want us to lose it. That's all, you know? I'm not even when it comes to some people that claim they're a private student, Mr. Parker. Look, I really don't want to burn anybody. I mean, I know people out there, they have forged certificates, and there was a time that there were people that would happen. And there was even a couple of stories where Mr. Pick was sent to their school. And I know one particular individual. He walked into a school, saw the fake certificate on the wall, pulled it off the wall, broke it over his leg, tore it in half. The instructor came over, tried to put his hands on my pick. He knocked him out. And then when the person came to, they later asked if they could train under pick. And now, however that worked out, what I liked about it was there was this consequence out there in the wind, and all of a sudden you wouldn't have. I don't want anybody to get hurt, but the it seems a brutal idea, but the threat of violence keeps men civil, and the threat of consequence keeps everybody probably a little more honest. And the main goal is just so the unknown or the unknowing don't get misled. That's all, you know.
Yeah,
And I have a
absolutely.
lot of compassion for the insecure that are desperately going for some sense of power, by being viewed a certain way. I really do have a lot of compassion for that. And who knows, maybe I'm guilty of it at times without even being aware of it, So anyway, that's part of why I think it's so important we try to, keep intact what really happened, you know.
Yeah, no, I agree.
That's
I
all.
agree. I agree. Very, very well said. So let's go ahead and move into our lightning round. I mean,
Oh, sure.
there's so many other things that we could get into, and we'll schedule some more sessions here.
Okay, got
but
it.
yeah, we'll move into our lightning round. So just a few little questions to
Sure.
wrap things up. First thing being, do you have a favorite technique?
Ooh. Wow, my God, that's a great question. I don't know that I do, But I am a fan of Fatal Deviation.
Okay.
I really like being in the middle of a flurry of punches, and then that push drag into a forward bow, making them run into a door, so to speak, mm-hmm. or like making them run into a wall. I like that about Fatal Deviation. Yeah, maybe.
It's a good one. It's a good one. Right. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
Ooh. Oh, God. Yeah. You know, Mr. Hawkins once said that Wes Idle can turn anything into a parry. And I think God has gifted me with the ability to round corners, so to speak. So all of my forms, I think I can make them flowing. But I do all my forms and sets in one run once a week. So I have all the weapons right there by the side, so I can just grab them and go into it.
Oh, nice.
It takes me, I don't know, 45 minutes or something to go through all of them. Mm-hmm. Maybe sometimes less, depending on how fast I'm going. Mm-hmm. And I do get pretty happy in that section where I'm doing forms 4 through 6. So it's hard to say. If I could say 4, 5, and 6 as one form, those might be my favorite.
Okay. That's a good answer. I like it.
Although I am a fan of some parts of knife set too. Mm-hmm. There's parts of knife set that make me smile. So
very nice. I like it.
So
like
there you
it.
Go.
I like it. That's good answer. Right. Do you have a favorite weapon?
I'm probably going to say the knife.
All right.
I think there is an idea that Mike Pick had mentioned that Kempo, he believes that this system was supposed to evolve into, in its highest form, a knife system. Now, with that said, that's a really interesting idea, and there's certainly a lot of evidence to that, given that the highest forms in the system are knife forms. I favor the blade quite, the edged weapon, handheld edge weapon, quite a bit, because there's so much you can do with them. There's so much blocking, there's so much trapping, and of course there's so much you can do to their body internally if you know what you're doing. So I'm probably going to say the knife, but maybe that's because I really learned Kempo knife from Mike Pick. No, maybe I would feel differently if I learned it from somebody else. But
no,
there you go.
I agree with you. I agree with you. No, if we're talking knives, and you know, if you don't have Mr. Pick in the conversation, like shouldn't even bring it up. So
I agree.
Sure. I like that. All right. And the last question, if there is anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be? And this can
Ed Parker.
I meant to get that
without
in there.
Hesitation.
Besides Ed Parker.
Besides Ed Parker.
This is okay, a Kempo podcast. So of course everyone is going to say Ed Parker. So,
but let me state, the two reasons it would be Ed Parker, but I'll give you the other answer. I'm always moved at how individuals think, and you can only really find that by sharing time and a shared interest. At the same time, I don't know, feeling somebody hit you the way they hit you is like a whole nother conversation. So anyway. But not Ed Parker. Okay.
It could be anybody.
Albert Einstein.
All right. I think you are the first.
He's one of my heroes.
I think you're the first.
He's one of my heroes. He said, near the end of his life, he made the statement, he'd gotten very spiritual, or God respecting, or I don't know what the term you want to use. But in the end of his life, he made a statement that at the end of my formulas, I can tell you how, but I still can't tell you why. There's something intelligent in play. That would be a very interesting person to spend time with.
For sure.
There you go.
I like it. All right. Well, now is your time for shameless self-promotion. So you can plug anything you want or anything that you want to bring up that we didn't talk about. You have the floor, and then we'll close out for today.
I would simply say that anyone is very welcome to get in touch with me. My email is w@idol.la. That's w@idol.la. And I'm happy to answer any questions or connect you with anybody you might want to be connected with. I know Brian Hawkins, we have three schools in Los Angeles area, but most importantly, I mean anybody in the world. There's some amazing Kempuists in many different countries on our beloved planet. And I know a bunch in South America, in England, in Ireland, in Australia, and there's some really, really great people, and certainly around the States, United States of America. So anybody, they are welcome to contact me, and I'm happy to answer any questions they may have.
Very nice. I like it.
So there you go.
I like it. Yeah, no, thank you so much for being on. I know we can talk and I'm sure we will, but we won't for this recording. Listeners, sorry, not sorry, but this is at this time, this is officially the longest episode I've done so far. So,
oh my. Okay. I hope that's good thing.
Oh, it's good for me. If the listeners have a problem with it, you know, it's my show, so we'll deal with it. But no, I can't thank you enough, and we will certainly talk more, and we'll do some more episodes and stuff down the road, and just thank you for your time, thank you for your knowledge and your stories, and I can't wait to get this together to the listeners' ears, and so. Just thank you again.
Oh,
and,
Mr. Darden, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkempo.com. Thank you.